Support for ClimateCast comes from Bank of America, financing clean energy initiatives and advancements in renewable energy, and spurring innovation in and the growth of environmentally focused companies, markets, and jobs. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
I wanted to find out what a wind technician actually does. So I went to the town of Sweetwater, out on the West Texas Plains, where I met Heath Ince at the base of a towering wind turbine, or turbine, as they say it in Texas.
Well, that's NPR's Ari Shapiro checking out a wind turbine firsthand. I'm Tom Cran. Paul Huttner's here with this week's Climate Cast. And Paul, we know wind energy is booming in the Midwest. And you found a big new wind energy project in Oklahoma. It might be the biggest one yet in the country, right?
Indeed. And we know wind energy is climate friendly, but market economics show wind energy is also becoming one of the cheapest energy sources to produce. And this new $4.5 billion Oklahoma project is called the Wind Catcher Energy Connection. It's expected to be done by 2020, and when finished, it will generate 9 million megawatt hours of wind power. That's enough, Tom, for about 800,000 homes. This project is part of an emerging trend toward huge wind farms. I asked Fresh Energy Science Policy Director J. Drake Hamilton why we're seeing a trend toward bigger wind projects.
We're seeing states that are in what we call the Saudi Arabia of wind, so the Great Plains all the way from North Dakota down through Oklahoma and Texas, they're taking advantage of economic momentum, no-cost fuel in the wind, and low stable electricity prices that many utilities are now taking advantage of for their customers.
So what do these huge projects look like? Is it just more of what we see in southern Minnesota and Iowa?
Like in Minnesota, you would be able to grow crops, or in the case of Oklahoma, you might be talking about ranch land. And so you would still be using that land for that purpose very productively. But a couple hundred feet up in the air, you'd be tapping zero-cost wind as a fuel and turning that into power. So it's a way of diversifying the economy. And in the case of Oklahoma, I love that the result is going to be for those customers that over the 20-year life of their contract, $300 million in local tax payments will go to those rural counties and those rural school districts. So it's really an economic win-win for parts of the Great Plains.
And I assume, are those farmers and ranchers getting paid, too, to allow that wind on their land?
Yeah, typically the farmers and ranchers would be leasing the wind rights to their land, and they would get compensated for that over a 20 or 25-year contract period. So they're able to do what in Minnesota they call harvest their third crop. They're growing corn and soybeans below the wind turbines, and then they're also selling their local supply of wind for the benefit of local customers.
You mentioned the economic advantages of building projects like this. How much of this is tax credits and how much is market-driven these days?
Both market and tax credits are important, and the tax credits are federal tax credits that will phase out over the next couple of years, so smart utilities are taking advantage of wind while it's on sale. However, we don't expect that the price for wind will do anything but continue to drop. It's now at all-time lows, and we expect that the market drivers, including big and small companies who are asking their utilities to provide up to 100% of their power from the wind and the sun, is another important driver for the economics.
Critics of wind power point out these projects don't generate power when the wind doesn't blow. How do energy producers overcome that in their portfolio?
The way we keep the lights on when any power plant goes offline, and that could be a nuclear plant or a coal plant or a wind plant, is that we're hooked up to a multi-state grid. For example, I'm in Minnesota. We're part of a 15-state and one Canadian province grid. And in our grid, there are over 200 wind power plants. So the wind is always blowing somewhere. And when that wind is blowing, those electrons are the lowest cost that any utility can put out for their customers. So it's a great deal.
There's a lot of investment going on here, Jay. Power utilities putting a lot into wind and solar now. As a scientist, I know that's good for the atmosphere, but are there business risks here? Could there be sort of a renewable energy bubble in the future?
You know, the biggest hedge against future economic risk is that the wind and the sun and other renewable technologies have no fuel costs. So that's what helps keep their prices low and stable over the lifetime of, say, a 20-year or 25-year contract that a utility company might hold with a particular power plant project. So that means these are great risk hedges for utilities, because we know that the cost of every other type of fuel, whether it's oil or coal or natural gas, is quite unpredictable and varies quite a lot over time. So many businesses who are interested in this taking advantage of renewable energy are really taking advantage of low, stable, no-cost fuels.
And what do you know, we see these investment dollars flowing into renewables. Why is investment money flowing into renewable energy at such a rapid rate?
Yeah, a number of investors and banks, I think Chase Bank this week announced that they're going to make very large investments. They're going to invest, I think, $200 billion in clean energy financing. And they're themselves working to get to 100% renewable energy by 2020. These are, of course, large increments of private investments, and they're absolutely essential for providing growth opportunities for those investors. They see them as very strong growth opportunities, and they're also very important for fighting climate change and global warming on a global basis.
You mentioned 100% renewable energy. Sounds great, but is it realistic for us to achieve that?
Yeah, we don't quite know how to get to 100% renewable energy today and have utter reliability on the system, which of course is important to all of us. But we know how to do that with about 80 or 85% renewable energy, and we're a long way from that. In Minnesota, we're getting about 22% of our electricity from renewables. Oklahoma, with that big project that was announced last week, that power company will get about 40% of their energy from wind power by 2020. So the numbers are creeping up. We need to amp them up even further. But we know how to keep the lights on with large increments of wind and solar, in part because we also have the traditional sources of energy, and the cost of battery storage that someday will be needed for backup are coming down fast as well.
Let's talk about demand. Customers, we all pay utility bills. What's the level of customer demand for renewables now?
You know, we're seeing that customers, individuals, especially young consumers, they expect that every product they buy in the near future will be manufactured using wind and solar power. That's just what they expect. They expect to see progress. They expect to see a cleaner electricity system. And fortunately, the market economics are now making that possible. We're also seeing the demand coming from big companies, everyone from Apple and Google and Amazon. And, you know, brand names like General Mills and Target and many others are insisting that their utility companies take a look at what price they can offer them for 100% renewable energy today, because those companies are also looking at financial forecasts, and they're seeing that right now the cost of a new wind plant is cheaper than the cost of an existing coal plant. And they want to take advantage of those lower prices for their customers.
Jay Drake Hamilton with Fresh Energy. You're really good at explaining this stuff. Thanks for the insight today on ClimateCast.
Thank you very much.
So just how big is the impact of all these big wind energy projects on jobs? The fastest growing job category in the U.S. is now wind energy technician. The American Wind Energy Association says 14,000 wind jobs were added in the U.S. last year, and that wind now employs more than 100,000 workers in the United States.
Wow. Well, I understand, Paul, you're watching some news events this week, one very wet and one very hot. Both have a link to climate.
Indeed. Two extreme weather events this week that have that clear climate link. First, Miami. 7 inches of rain fell there on Tuesday. That's not that unusual in Miami. But the combination of extreme rainfall, sea level rise, and high tide caused the city's drainage system to just back up. All that water had nowhere to go. So buildings were flooded. Streets were flooded and cars floating up to the curb. Now, sea level in Miami has gone up about a foot since many of the drainage systems were built, and that baseline rise in sea level puts enough back pressure into the drains to cause water to back up and to flood many streets and buildings like it did Tuesday. Pacific Northwest, a different story. Extreme heat, 110 to 115 in Portland and Seattle. Ooh. That may set some all-time records this week. A recent New York Times analysis of summer heat shows the number of extremely hot days now greatly exceeds the number of extremely cold days in the U.S. since the 1950s. Tom, the data shows a shift of even 2 to 3 degrees from average, shifts that bell curve far enough to the right to produce many more extremely hot days.
Wow. All right. Paul Huttner with this week's Climate Cast. You hear it Thursdays at this time. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Tom.